Alrighty. Good morning yet again. like the third time I've said that, but for the regulars here, of course, I already know this, but we're going through most of the books of the Bible through this year. Just doing an overview and then a selected story relating somehow to that book of the Bible. And so we're up to the book of Galatians. And I, if there's, I do these outlines, for any of our visitors to, I'll get a prop, to go along with a, sheet that I have in the lobby. So I follow this basic template every time. So if you have kids or if you're an adult, and you want to take notes along, you can use that as a, you know, pre-made up sheet to follow along with. But anyway, so of course we are in the New Testament, and so all of them fit in our timeline, right there around the time of Jesus and the apostles, but zooming in, to a little after that, because that first timeline covers about 4,000 years. This one covers about 100. we put the book of Galatians fairly early in Paul's time of writing. I didn't check to see if it was his first or not. And there's a thing about whether he wrote this before or after the events of Acts 15. Which doesn't really change anything, but it's something that people like to ponder on, because a lot of, like chapter 2, for example, is very, very similar sounding to Acts 15, and so is he talking about something that already happened, or is this what he was kind of working on before the big debate in Acts 15, which is about circumcision, as is the book of Galatians? So not sure. Just know that some people see it either way. It could fit, either one, no matter how you take the timeline. So, nothing definitive there, but I guess just as a reminder, let me go back a second. We've done Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and, this is the book of Galatians, and this does not take place after 1st and 2nd Corinthians. It does not take place after. It's in your Bible after 1st and 2nd Corinthians, but these events most almost certainly take place no matter what timeline you're going on, whether it's before or after Acts 15. This takes place before the events of 1st Corinthians. Does that really change anything? I mean, again, not really for your study. Not that I'm aware of. I've probably changed something, but I'm not aware, and I certainly won't mention it today if it does. But just know that these books are not in timeline order of Paul's letters. They hop all around. It's based on length. We started with the longest ones, and then we're going shorter. Is how our Bibles are arranged by whoever it was that decided these things. I don't know. Anyway, so let's dive in. The book of Galatians is about Paul making sure that people understand that Christians do not need to observe the Old Testament laws, which is maybe a little surprising, right? Because there's this huge chunk of your Bibles, and he's saying, you don't need to follow that anymore. And like, what? No, we've got to require circumcision, right? And he's saying, no, and he's quite insistent on this. So to be clear, that's his theme. He's talking about whether or not people need to follow the Old Testament laws. He mostly just says circumcision. Now, of course, if you're a woman, well, that's it's not that hard to follow. It never really affected you in the first place in that sense, right? But he's not saying circumcision just to talk about circumcision. He's really saying it as a stand-in, as a phrase that means the whole old law, the law of Moses. You can think of it like a nickname. The fancy word is synecdoche or metonymy, kind of. I tried to look up what's the right one. It said synecdoche. but I guess it's a subdivision of metonymy. I don't know. Anyway, it's a word. It's a circumcision just is a stand-in for the whole thing. Examples you might find online of this is like, you know, when you hear a news story and it says, reports from the White House that, taxes are being eliminated for everybody or whatever. Yeah, right. You wish, right? But, you know, the White House, the building didn't say anything, right? It's the government that's actually saying it, right? The White House is a stand-in for the U.S. government. So in the same way, he says circumcision, but it's a stand-in for the old law. So just kind of keep that in mind when he's talking about that. It's like, this is a really long book to talk about circumcision. Well, that's not entirely the point. He's saying that as a part of a greater thing. Why this is special? Because Paul is hopping mad. he starts out this book with a bang. This is not the shortest introduction, but, he goes very rapidly, starting in verse 6 of, I can't believe you people, you're giving up on the faith, you know? And it's like, whoa, like, okay, I guess we better read this. So, I mean, he just comes out swinging. he tells a story about, from his past, about how he had to confront the Apostle Peter, about an issue with circumcision and not associating with Jews, and to kind of have it, you know, the best of both worlds. And he had to, you know, like publicly shame him for this. So he's just, you know, very like, he's pulling out all the stops. Chapter 5, verse 12, where he says, the people that are teaching you this, that, you know, everyone needs to be circumcised. He says, I wish they would emasculate themselves, is what some translations say. I think some will say cut themselves off or something like that. But, it's most scholars think he's saying exactly what it sounds like, which is a very graphic thing of, you know, I wish they would cut off a body part to really, you know, put their money where their mouth is. Like it's not about this. And so he's really, really just not letting this go. And to be this focused on a single theme so clearly, I mean, you know, we talk about these other books where you have to kind of discern, you know, what's the central theme of this book? There's no doubt in this one. he latches on to the circumcision thing and he does not let go, except maybe briefly toward the end to say, you know, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness. Anyway. the main characters, Paul's the author, the recipients of this letter, the Christians in Galatia. Like I say, I'm going to go back and forth. These are letters. We also call them books of the Bible. Well, my laptop decided it was done. Ah, I think it ran out of battery. Okay, well, it's going to be a minute before that comes back up. I have these printed out, so we're going to go off of that. So I'm sorry for those taking notes because it's a lot easier to see it on the screen, but it's going to be a minute before this boots back up. I have to turn it on. Okay, so you're going to have to listen. Sorry. So Paul's writing to the Christians in Galatia. it seems almost certain that these Galatians, these Christians in the region of Galatia are Gentiles. Okay, so that's two. Again, I'm trying to be sensitive to the fact if you're taking notes. Character number one, Paul. Character number two, the Christians in Galatia. Character number three is the Judaizing teachers. That's a big word. So sorry. There we go. Good. That was fast. I'm glad it came up reasonably fast. So the people that are trying to say that circumcision is still necessary. And then Abraham, of course, died hundreds, maybe thousands of years ago before this, but he's brought up a lot, as a memory of, circumcision, because the covenant of circumcision was given to Abraham. So he's mentioned a lot. We're gonna get there. Oh, joy. Now, on the other hand, this does not want to be responsive to... Okay. Sorry, technical difficulties. Okay. For an outline, you could condense this a bit if you wanted. So chapter 5, verse 13 through chapter 6, verse 10. I always start in the middle because this is where I tend to focus. Usually there's something in the middle that kind of is concrete in these outlines, and then you kind of work outward. That's how I tend to find myself doing these outlines, as I'm trying to see what's going on. So, like I said, there's this section where he finally stops mentioning circumcision, and that's chapter 5, verse 13 through chapter 6, verse 10. So he talks about the fruit of the Spirit and bearing one another's burdens, just basically being kind to one another. Everything else is about circumcision in some way or another. So he starts out with this kind of reprimand and the greeting. And the first 9 verses, then chapter 1, verse 10, through the end of chapter 2, he tells his personal story. And he says, well, you know, this is about, you know, it's like, I've been there, and this is what I went through, and this is why this is important to me. And then starting in chapter 3 through the middle of verse 12, the middle of chapter 5, it's his persuasive essay, where he's like, this is why, this is the way, here's my proof, here's my evidence. And then he concludes it at the end, right? So, all right. And so as far as theology and doctrine in the book, if I'm missing something, let me know, but I see this is a pretty one note book. and it is on this point that does a Christian need to follow the Old Testament laws? Of course, I gave this away at the beginning and said no, but to, kind of flesh this out a little bit more, I don't think you can get a more resounding no than by reading this book, if you ever wondered. Again, he focuses on circumcision, but the point is the whole law and to kind of spell that out, in a little more detail. you know, he talks in a few spots like Galatians 2:21. You know, if that's the case, then why did Christ even die? The whole point was he died so the law could die, so that there would be, you know, salvation. He does mention the only thing that I'm aware of where he kind of elaborates a little more is in chapter 4, verse 10, where he talks about you observe days and months and seasons and years, and so that may hint at the idea of, you know, Jewish ritual observances. So days would be maybe Sabbath days, and months and seasons or in the years or other, you know, feasts and festivals. and so then going a little beyond what's stated here, we would kind of expand this to the idea, just from other scriptures, of course, that other things in the old law are not binding on us, about eating pork, sacrificing animals, and various other things. The Old Testament's just not binding on us today. It's of much use, but not binding on every single law that had their place in time and are not binding now. But you could still observe these things. Paul is seen doing this in the book of Acts. So, he, again, we don't know whether this is before or after this book, but in Acts chapter 16 and verse 3, he asks Timothy to be circumcised. Now, that's quite surprising when he's so anti-circumcision. His problem is requiring it of people, right? To choose to do so is fine, and may have, you know, a reason for it. Like in this case, where he wanted Timothy to fit in a way. And then another scene in Acts 21 verses 20 through 26, where he helps these men that are. It seems that he pays for them. He's asked to. We assume he did. for men that are completing a Jewish vow at the temple. So very Jewish observance going on there. And so he's right there with them. And that's an interesting scene. That's in chapter 21, if you want to go and read that, where, you know, there's people are accusing Paul of just throwing away the law of Moses. And, obviously he's of the mind it's not necessary, or required of Christians, but he's like, well, it's still good to observe it though. I mean, you know, there's some use in that. So, all right. So we went through that quite quickly. We'll spend a little more time on, the stories we usually do. If you want to get ahead, we'll be in Genesis chapter 16. Genesis 16. But I'll leave this up for any that are scrambling to keep up, to take notes, because I know I go quite rapidly through these points. This is also my time to take another drink of water. All right, so Genesis 16, and this is the story of, I just said Hagar, to make it simple. To get more detailed than that, makes it a very long title. Story of Sarah and Abraham and Hagar and Ishmael. So let's just say Hagar to simplify things. So I've chosen this story because in Galatians 4, it is, I'm pretty sure I'm writing that before I stick my foot in my mouth. Galatians 4, 21 through 31 cites this story and the situation about Sarah and Hagar and the child of promise. And so it's one of those dense little sections of scripture. And so it's helpful to know the story. So I thought it would be good to go over that story while we have this time. So in the story, again, there's a lot going on in 16 verses. So it's kind of hard to summarize it quickly. I'm doing my best. But Hagar is not, and like, I think it was last week, the New Testament, when citing, so in the Old Testament, it says Abram. His name's changed to Abraham. Sarah, at this point, also will later get her name changed. In this story, I've always heard it said Sarai. Now, when you read the New Testament and it talks about these stories, the New Testament will just say Sarah and Abraham. It'll use the later names. And so I don't feel that bad if I slip up and I say Abraham instead of Abram. And so just know, I know what I'm supposed to say. I'm supposed to say Abram. I'm going to slip. But just, you know, have mercy. Okay. So the story, Hagar is not Abram's wife. She's Sarah's maidservant. But Hagar has a son for Abram. Red flag. fights with Sarah. There's seems like jealousy or other kind of contempt there. And literally, long story short, Hagar runs away. The end result of this, of course, is this is the birth of Ishmael, which is Abraham's first son. And we focus more on Isaac. Isaac's the son of promise. And he will come later in the book of Genesis. But God had promised them a son. So they waited about 10 or 11 years, and no son came along. And so it seems they took matters in their own hand and said, well, we'll make sure Abraham has a son. It'll just be with Hagar. And that's not, it seems, what God wanted. He wanted them to wait 25 years until Abraham was 100 and Sarah 90. to give birth to Isaac. So this is Ishmael's story and Hagar, quite a few years before that, about 14, 15 years before this, before Isaac. But in all this, even though a lot of questionable decisions by the adults here, Ishmael's still blessed at the end. all right. So that's supposed to be the angel of the Lord, not Jesus, in this picture. there's a whole other story there. Anyway, but why is this story special? And it's the beginning of the idea of the Son of Promise. So I've been saying this phrase, and this comes up in Galatians 4, and we're going to read that section later. But to spell this out a bit, you know, it's obviously not... Ishmael's not the first son, or Ishmael is the first son, but he doesn't automatically become the Son of Promise. That's going to be blessed in important ways. That comes later with Isaac, right? we see that kind of emerge here, and this comes up later, right? Jacob as well is chosen in this way. You know, Samuel is kind of dedicated and born to a woman who's barren, though not after that. You know, John the Baptist and Jesus kind of fit this mold in different ways. So it's a very, you know, kind of foundational story for the Bible. All right, so main characters, Abram, which if you say Abraham, that's just fine. and he was promised a son way back 10 years ago or so. Sarai, or Sarah, just assumes after a decade that she's not going to be the mom after all. She thought she would, and yes, she will. She just had to wait longer still, but 10 years is a while. You can understand. Hagar, who would logically probably be a bit younger than Sarah, if it was kind of assumed that she's not going to have that much trouble bearing children. She's probably quite a bit younger than Sarah, who's, what's the math work out to, like 76 around this time. you got the angel of the Lord that talks to Hagar after she runs away. And, of course, Ishmael, who's just a baby at the end of the story. He's kind of the point of the story, but he doesn't actually show up to the end. And he's the son of Hagar and Abraham. Great. All right. So for our outline, and we'll go ahead and read this story after this. But first three verses where Sarah, you know, basically has given up and tells Abram to have a child with Hagar, and Abram apparently thinks that's a great idea. But this happens, and Hagar then looks down on Sarah, or treats her with contempt. I was trying to find a way to put that in more approachable English, but you know, contempt. So you get some sort of like smugness or jealousy or something going on there, where she's just you know, like, oh, I had a kid, and it's like, you know, and I wanted to make a note. So I struggled with understanding what was going on here for a while. I thought Sarah was the first one to look down, because in verse 3 it says, and really, I mean, the subject in verse 4, in verse 4. The subject is Hagar, so it should be obvious that she is the she and the her is Hagar the whole way through. So, I mean, in hindsight, I don't know why I missed it, but I'll just read verse 4 real quick. It says, and he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. So I was just bouncing all over the place, because I saw mistress, and I just thought the woman that's not married to the guy. Wrong. This is an old term. The mistress is Sarah. Okay? So, like, you think of, with men, if a man has a slave, He's the master, right? So I think it's the same idea. Sarah's the woman that has Hagar as a as her own slave. Sarah's the mistress, like the master, basically, but a female master. So the word in some of your translations is the mistress, but not the mistress like we think of that word, which is the other woman, right? So that tripped me up, and I just want to kind of flag that. When it says mistress, that means Sarah, and it spells it out in verse 8 at the end, where Hagar says, I'm fleeing from my mistress, Sarah. It's like, oh, I got it now. So, So verses 6 through 8, Hagar runs away. Then the angel of the Lord comforts her. Hagar says a blessing of like praise to the Lord. This is one of those times where the angel of the Lord is there, and then all of a sudden it says the Lord said this, and you're like, wait, what happened? When did the Lord come on the scene? You know, it's one of those. and then Ishmael's born at the end. So, okay, let's read it. Genesis 16, starting verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to be, gave her to her husband, to Abram, Abram to be his wife. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. So I kind of skimmed over that detail earlier, but Sarah's not innocent in this story either. She actually seems to be kind of cruel after Hagar wasn't all that great either. So a lot of not great activity by the, like I said, the adults in the story. Verse 7, and the angel of the Lord found her, Hagar, by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress, and submit thyself under her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction, and he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, Thou God seest me, for she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Wherefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old, or 86, when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. All right. So one little fun detail that I think is interesting. The name Hagar in Hebrew is roughly the same word as a foreigner, translations might say stranger or sojourner. I could get into the technical. It's a thing with Hebrew where the vowels were kind of optional for a time, and so they're spelled with the same consonants, Hagar and Hager, I think is the foreigner word. but it would be if you spoke Hebrew, it would presumably be quite obvious the subtlety or not subtlety of the similarity in words. Then remember, from verse 1, that Hagar is an Egyptian woman. So put these things together, and that's pretty interesting. Hagar, whose name sounds like foreigner, the Egyptian, was oppressed in Sarah's house. And in a chapter before this, not to mention we just know the story of Moses and the Exodus and everything, but Genesis 15 and verse 13 says, "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger or foreigner in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict or oppress them 400 years." So the descendants of Sarah are going to be foreigners, not Hagar, right? The descendants of Sarah are going to be foreigners oppressed in Egypt. Kind of an interesting twist. But again, that's prophesied before the story that we just read. And then as a command in the law of Moses, it says, the Israelites were told, you shall not oppress a sojourner, a foreigner, a Hagar. You know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. It's an interesting kind of connection between these two different paths that the women and their children took, Sarah and Hagar and Ishmael and Isaac, and such. So, all right. So now let's go ahead and turn to Galatians 4. Oh my, I'm sorry about that. Well, let's just unplug this. That's going. It's not a good day for technology, huh? Oh, it's still doing it. Okay, we're winging it. All right, Galatians 4. I'm sorry. Is everyone all right? No one got a stroke or anything from that? That was off the chain. I'm sorry about that. All right, Galatians 4. All right, so this ties into the story. He makes a point, and I'm going to... It's even doing something to the speaker now. I'm sorry. I'm going to mute it. Okay. Very sorry. Okay. Galatians 4, starting verse 21 is... That's where we'll end up reading. So Paul is making this connection to Sarah and Hagar. And it might have been that. I might have just had the book on the remote. That might have been my problem. I might have been self-inflicted there. I'm not going to try again. So, recap. The Jews come through Sarah, not Hagar. Sarah had Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob, and so on. Jacob changed his name to Israel, or his name was changed to Israel, and you get the nation of Israel through Sarah, not through Hagar. And so Paul makes a point about the old law, and he says, think about the story of Hagar. And he doesn't say Sarah, but it's kind of implied. I don't think he says Sarah. I don't think he says her name outright. and so he says, you know, just think about the story of Hagar, which we just read, right? And so you're thinking, okay, well, he's going to say, you know, and the Jews are, you know, they were the people who were doing what's right. So obviously they come through Sarah. And he says, the Jews are like Hagar. And you're like, what? And he just throws a curveball at you here. So try to keep track of that as he makes this argument. But his point is that just like, Hagar was a slave in the household of Abraham. The Jews, because they have not accepted Christ, is the way I take it, because they're still under the old law, they're in slavery too. And so they really are following the path of Hagar. It's interesting because he's writing to what I think is a Gentile audience. But I mean, imagine if the Jews heard this, they'd probably be quite upset by this. But anyway, we'll just go ahead and read it. I'm not going to, I think we've kind of dug into this enough to spare you any further interpretation. But to tie it together, Galatians 4, starting verse 21. Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid and the other by a free woman. Sarah and Hagar, right? But he who was born of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, not the promise, in other words, but he of the free woman was by promise. Which things are an allegory for these two covenants? The one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is in Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, like a heavenly, is free, which is the mother of us all. So he's speaking to a Gentile audience who are not descended from Sarah. And he's saying she's, or spiritually, that sort of freedom in Sarah is the mother of us all. Verse 27, for it is written, rejoice thou, barren, that bearest not, break forth and cry, thou that travailest not, for the desolate hath many more children than she which hath an husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what saith the scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Alright, so, no point for me to use the recap. Oh, that's not even going to advance the slide. Alright, just going off my notes. but that'll wrap up our reading there, in Genesis 16. If you would, I usually like to end with a poem. So if you would turn to Isaiah 54, and this is what Paul quoted in Galatians 4. So in Galatians 4:27, he quotes Isaiah 54 verse 1 about the barren woman having children. So this is the reason I've chosen this as our poem reading to wrap up the lesson for today. But I do want to warn, this chapter 54 of Isaiah, the first verse is what he uses to quote in Galatians 4. I would not extend that thought and metaphor, whatever you want to call it, prophecy, whatever, to the rest of the chapter. It really does not fit. once you get to like verses 7 and 8, I have forsaken thee. If this is about Sarah, that's the opposite, right? Sarah's has the child of promise. And so, in a little wrath, I have hid my face from thee for a moment. And that almost sounds like it would be speaking to Hagar if that was continuing on. And so, the rest of it, I wouldn't in any way try to shoehorn this into being about Sarah. I think he's just quoting verse 1 just to quote it. The rest of it, the context is more of an exile, returning after exile sort of prophecy. But anyway, we'll go ahead and read this, Isaiah 54, and then we'll wrap up. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing, and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on thy right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame, for thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood any more. For thy Maker is thine husband. The Lord of hosts is his name, and the Redeemer Thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called. For the Lord hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit and a wife of youth, when thou wast refused, saith thy God. Of course, Sarah was not a wife of youth, as she was quite the opposite. So again, this is where it starts to break down, if you wanted to carry that through. Verse 7, for a small moment I have forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness I will have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth, so I have sworn that I would not be wroth with thee, nor rebuke thee. For the mountains shall depart, and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord that hath mercy on thee. O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors, and lay thy foundations with sapphires, and I will make thy windows of agates, and thy gates of carbuncles, and all thy borders of pleasant stones, and all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be thy peace of thy children. In righteousness shalt thou be established, thou shalt be far from oppression. For thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee. Behold, they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth the coals in the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy. This is going to sound like a song we're about to sing. Verse 17, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and the righteousness, their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord. So as we conclude here and extend the invitation, we've read this story that talks about the comfort of the Lord and his safety. And we'll sing that song in a second, actually. As it says in verse 17, or it says in the song, no weapon that's fashioned against thee shall stand. but we, and then of course we read the story of Hagar, and despite much questionable choices throughout, the Lord sent the angel of the Lord to comfort Hagar in the wilderness. And so we extend the invitation that the Lord is waiting for you also. If you are lost and astray, have either never obeyed the call of the gospel or need to come back and repent and start living right again, then the comfort of the Lord is there for you as well. and so we encourage you to come forward if you need these things as we stand and sing the song of invitation.